From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Alex Beam says that in 1844, Joseph Smith was a man at the height of his powers. He was revered by a growing number of adherents. He presided over a city larger than Chicago at the time. And of course, he was running for president. But of course, he was also reviled and hated. And in the spring of that year, he was killed. Killed by a mob, is how the story is usually told. But in a new book, Beam gets more particular about that mob, who they were, and the real reason they wanted him dead. Beam is in Utah this week, and he's joining us to talk about the book. It's called American Crucifixion. Joseph Smith's murder was tragic for Mormons, but Beam says it also marked a period of progress for the faith that continues today. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It can't be easy writing about Mormon founder Joseph Smith. For believers, Smith was a prophet, brilliant and beloved. For many non-believers, he was a fraud, a megalomaniac who couldn't keep his ambitions in check or his hands to himself. Alex Beam has had to manage his own impressions of Joseph Smith as he spent more than 2 years exploring the man. His new book is very focused. It plays out in a very compressed moment of time when Joseph Smith is jailed and then killed in Carthage by a mob. Beam explains in his book this was no ordinary mob, though. It had prominent figures in it, a newspaper editor, a state senator, a justice of the peace. And they weren't content to exile Smith or imprison him. They, of course, wanted him dead. His book, he says, is about why. It's called American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Alex Beam is in town reading from the book, talking about it, and he's joining us on the program today. We invite you to join us as well. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe and the International Herald Tribune. This is his fifth book. And as I said, we'll give you details about the readings. He has one in Salt Lake and one in Park City. We'll tell you about that later. Alex Beam, welcome.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Thank you for having me. Well, I wanted to start with how much it is you did know in those early days when someone suggested this might be a good idea for a book, Alex Beam. What did you know about Joseph Smith in those
Absolutely
days?
Nothing.
Really?
Absolutely nothing. And that was actually fairly helpful in writing the book because I had to write the book for men and women who were readers, who liked to read books, but who knew nothing about Joseph Smith.
So no preconceived ideas or notions?
That would be naive. I think everyone outside of the Mormon culture zone does have preconceived ideas about Mormonism as a faith. And they know the, you know, of course they know the odd, somewhat irrelevant fact about Joseph Smith. There's one – in my American history book, I'm a little bit older than you. There's one line. It was killed by a mob in Carthage, Illinois. You have no idea where that was. And then every day I get, you know, quote, unquote, jokey emails, you know, bring me back some wives from Utah, blah, blah, blah. On the one hand, you and I might make light of that. But as you – again, you know, when Romney runs for president, people do political cartoons, you know, the way they depicted Brigham in the 1860s.
Yeah, first thing that comes up.
Right. But that's window dressing. I mean, so or if anything, that just underlines my point. People know nothing.
You say one of the dilemmas with starting from zero, though, is that you yourself had to come to grips with his legend. As I said, you have those contrasting views: prophet on one side, charlatan on the other. And surely you came to your own kinds of conclusions or your own kinds of impressions as you went, but I wonder if during this process you had to kind of keep that in check so you could approach it, if not objectively, certainly with some sort of, I don't know, distance in some way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I did not keep anything in check at all. I heard your intro and now – I mean, I always was looking for the middle path,
yeah,
I guess. the sort of the Sill and Charybdis of Joseph Smith biographies obviously are Fawn Brody and then the more recently Richard Bushman book. I mean, by accident, not by design, I read Brody first and Bushman last. But I never wanted to call Joseph a fraud. I never wanted to use that kind of language in this book. In a way, I'm at pains to explain why. I guess I'm somewhat religious. It seemed like the wrong path to me. On the other hand, I hope that there's sort of no aspect of Joseph's personality that I covered up or hid from the reader.
You know, it's interesting. I heard a few moments of an interview you did, I think it was yesterday, with this liberal Mormon group and this blogger, John DeLynn. And what was so interesting, I think, about it was how he was trying to push you, it seemed like, to be more emotional about Joseph Smith. And because he absolutely was. He was convinced about certain things, you know, and why don't you at least sound more outraged?
Yeah, yeah. No, it was a multi-hour experience.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just John.
No.
I mean, in a sense, metaphorically, the minute I set foot in Salt Lake City, I sort of didn't know what I was getting in for. DeLynn is a towering figure in the world of Mormon history and in getting men and women on the record and talking about Mormon history. That your characterization is exactly right. I was overwhelmed. 98%. I was overwhelmed by the embrace of people who liked the book, which is, as an author, is a very unusual feeling. And I am this kind of East Coast guy, and I'm going, you know, I'm pushing people away. Please don't love me this much, because that wasn't my purpose in writing the book. My purpose was not to enlighten you. It was to give you information, make you learn something. But I didn't want to change your faith in any way. I want people to live in the faith that they're comfortable with. And a lot of being with John and this fantastic group of smart people who had read my book was to cut to the chase. After we spent so many hours together, I finally realized that I was more empathetic towards the LDS and Joseph Smith than they were. And again, I speak the truth in love. I hope no one is offended by my saying that. But what a curious position for me to be in.
You write early in the book, most historians, not all, but of course most, have really ignored the death of Joseph Smith. What do you mean by that? Because people, of course, mention it. But maybe it's just sort of in passing. They haven't really explored that part of the story, you think?
Well, my claim is that this is the first non-Mormon popular history account of Joseph's death. There's an 800-page they're fictional. If we go to a library, there are faith-promoting accounts of this book. I mean, this is an attempt to write a sort of a secular, interesting, readable, factual account of really the days between June 6th and June 26th, this amazingly compressed, violent time when Joseph is alive, June 6th, and 3 weeks later he's dead, and to sort of write about that.
I mentioned this in the introduction, and I wanted to get you to say something just sort of broadly about this because we'll work into the particulars as we go. But you mentioned how Joseph Smith's old enemies in Missouri could have sent Joseph back to his old enemies in Missouri, this group. They could have sent him packing. They could have sent him into exile, could have imprisoned him. But they didn't. They killed him. And again, this goes to this violent sense of what's going on at that moment. But in general, put that in context, because violence is an undercurrent here, of course, because we're talking about this and it's playing out, we should say, on the American frontier. That seems an important element.
Yeah, that is important. And it's certainly hard for us to visualize, because to us the frontier is somewhere much further west. But the Mississippi River is literally the American frontier. It's the end of the settled United States. I mean, this is no secret to Mormons because of the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri. Mormons had been victims of violence. They had dispensed violence in Missouri. They provoked violence. This was a part of America where a lot of disagreements were settled by the gun or the noose. There's a literature on that. Certainly, I'm capitalizing on that literature. But the Mormons also, provoked for whatever reason, and we can certainly provoked really deep, visceral, hostile reactions among the people who surrounded them, you know, both in Missouri and then tragically, of course, as my book explains, in southwestern Illinois.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Joseph Smith's personality. Give us the groundwork. Let's start in 1844, because you say Joseph Smith is a man at the height of his powers. He's a national celebrity, more notorious than famous in some places, of course. But there's also some kind of – what do you figure is going on with him? Because you've talked about there being this kind of manic intensity going on in that time.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad you picked up on that, because that's in a way – that's the book I mean that is exactly what is happening in his life in 1844. There's a line in my book, you know, I use the term megalomania. I do kind of graciously say if he's exhibiting signs of megalomania, at least he came by it honestly. I think – I mean, this is clear, this is a low-key, subtle leitmotif in my book, although other writers have made it more manifest than latent. Joseph is operating, you know, at 6,000 revolutions per minute. You know, I'm trying to find a lot of circumlocutions for saying things are really speeding up in Joseph's life. Manic intensity is – those words are there for a reason. You know, new revelations are coming fast. New councils are being formed. You know, polygamous marriages are people being urged to enter them. If one were to read the book really carefully and saying, what is Alex really thinking? I think this is a flame that is burning too intensely and that is probably going to be snuffed out.
You point out Joseph Smith, he was not the first prophet of this second great awakening, that big tide of religious fervor that's going on in the 19th century you mentioned. But he was the most successful. You talk about at some point at Nauvoo when he gets there, the population is doubling by half every year. And I guess the question is, because you've described him as having this huge personality, and you write this in the book, you say people follow Joseph Smith partly because they believe God talked to him, but also because he talked to them. Is that part of the kind of the gift that he was willing to get onto the ground?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm so happy I included that block of text in the book, because people who read earlier versions, my wife, Scott, they said, you know, well, you've got a nice book here, but you don't really help us understand why people are coming from Manchester, England, risking their lives to come across the Atlantic and up the Mississippi to join this man. And that chapter actually is about something that the Mormons definitely emphasize when they talk about Joseph, which is, of course, his deep humanity. And he's a fascinating character because he bifurcated his own personality, especially at this time of his life, into like, well, here's what I do when I'm a prophet. I get these revelations from God. We write them down in the Doctrines and Covenants, or perhaps later. But then here's what I do when I'm a man. I wrestle with these kids. You know, I'm a kind of macho guy. I go down to the pier. He personally greets every man and woman who comes up the Mississippi. He's also running. I mean, John DeLynn focused on this. I mean, he's running a huge sort of PR operation. You know, a lot of people come to visit him. He revels in this. He revels in the treatment of the Eastern papers, even when it's hostile, although some Eastern editors are very favorable towards Joseph. But, you know, John C. Calhoun's kids come to visit him. All these Bostonian
right.
aristocrats
yeah.
come. But he likes that, and he's good at that. You know, he has a large winning personality. I mean, I hate to rave, but I mean, there's excerpts from his own diary in there where he talks about, you know, there's not enough whiskey here. I've got to go out and buy some more whiskey. I mean, he is, and Brigham says this also later after. I mean, he is a real salty human being, and I certainly don't mean any bizarre imprecations in that. He's a winning, charismatic personality who draws thousands of people to him.
His diary, you write about, there's this moment, this excerpt where he's, you know, he gets up and he's chopping wood and he's studying German, and then he goes, he sees these two kids fighting in the street, and he runs out and he breaks up the fight, and he says this remarkable thing. He says, "Nobody is allowed to fight in this city but me."
Right, right. And he says this to the two visiting Bostonian aristocrats, too. They challenge him on his powers. And he basically says, I can do what I want because I'm a prophet. But he's smiling when he says that. And of course, this is the Joseph that the LDS, I, you know, very truthfully presents. And because he is a person of sort of inexplicable grandeur and charisma. And I mean, I don't want to be the one to say this, but of course there are other sides to Joseph as well.
Yeah, which of course we'll get to it. Speaking of grandeur, he of course is running for president in 1844. And he sends his 12 apostles around the country to basically campaign for him.
Well, he sends us 130 so-called volunteers, right, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that's an odd part of Mormon history. It's one that I don't take very seriously, and I don't think any reasonable person should take Joseph Smith's presidential campaign seriously. However, I mean, there are academics, I mean, who disagree with me. There's an entire book that's been written arguing that Joseph would have, in a sense, been the key factor in the 1844 or 1848 presidential election, because supposedly he controlled so many votes in the counties that where the Mormons were in Illinois, that thus he controlled the electoral college vote of Illinois, and that Illinois thus would determine the I think this is delirious. I'm a little even uncomfortable hearing myself saying it.
Well, isn't it about mostly just saying that he had an incredibly expansive worldview, that this was about the kingdom of God, that's the vision, right?
Well, yeah, but those are two different things.
Yeah.
You know, his seeking temporal power in 1844 through the ballot box, which, I mean, of course, anybody could propose himself as a presidential candidate. But simultaneously, he is creating something called the Council of the Kingdom of God. He is declaring himself to be king of the kingdom of God, king of Israel. He brings 50 people together to be the men – there's no men and women – to be the men who will govern the Americas, and I think by implication the world, after Christ returns to earth. And then I was just at the Mormon History Association meeting in San Antonio, where they're kind of giving us an early glimpse of the so-called Council of 50 Minutes. And the guy stood up there and he said, well, Joseph had his cabinet already. I didn't – you know, in these meetings he had already designated the men who were going to actually have cabinet positions when he was elected president.
Wow.
In 1844. I didn't get their names. They weren't – but I mean – I think this is an imaginary world. Okay,
yeah.
That's my view.
So Joseph Smith is revered and he's notorious, but a crucial point about this time in 1844, which you mentioned, is that he, as you said, completely remade his religion. You put it this way: you say if one sentence could describe the last few months of his life, it would be "Wait, there's more." Talk a little bit about that. Baptism for the dead. He sort of starts talking differently about the nature of God, eternal progression, multiple gods. I mean, it's an astounding amount of sort of religious innovation.
Right. These are the Nauvoo doctrines. I'm not the world's greatest expert on Mormon theology, I would hasten to assure you. And I'm reasonably sure the King Follett sermon in which he puts forward, you know, Harold Bloom says this is the most important sermon ever preached in America. He puts forward the doctrine of eternal progression, the idea that God himself was once a human and that you and I, you know, can aspire to godhood. I believe that dates from this astonishing last 18 months of his life. Baptism of the dead, comes in 1842. It's again a revolutionary Nauvoo doctrine. And now it's become controversial in our time, although that – I mean, you know, I'm not the kind of raider who like lets a colorful detail slide by.
Right.
So the idea that he's taking Mormons out to the middle of the Mississippi, dunking them underwater and saying George Washington is now a Mormon. I mean, again, you know, God will strike me down, but I could not resist a detail like that. There's one other important religious doctrine. I'm kind of embarrassed. I'm not remembering it, but it's a time of tremendous theological ferment for Joseph personally, yes.
And it's about this time he starts to embrace Freemasonry. And he basically, I guess, as you write about it, sort of borrows the rituals and the symbols of the Masonry experience for the Mormon temple ceremony. And the reason I mention it, because you write a bit about this, the question comes up, why does he do that? And you say for Smith, the element that's important here is this idea of secrecy.
I do write that, having heard – I mean, first of all, Joseph's embrace of Masonry is extremely controversial, and I think the LDS takes Joseph at his word. He makes this extraordinary claim. Again, this is, I think, fraudulent, of course. He says that the Mormon endowment rituals predated, in some hypothetical history, the Masonic endowment rituals. It simply can't be true. Yes. I mean, secrecy is a huge element in the last 18 months of Joseph's life with these overlapping councils. And you know, Masonry is – I mean, even though they advertise on commercial radio in the United States, is essentially a secret ritual. But also – I mean, I also write – I don't know how much I emphasize this, but Joseph embraces Masonry also for kind of a networking reasons, because all the important people in Illinois, in Southwest, everybody who's important in America is a Mason.
And it's like joining a country club in some ways.
Precisely. Precisely. The banker's a member. Everybody you kind of need to know, the head of the radio station. And Joseph, a word I probably should use more, frankly, is canniness. Joseph is canny. He's intelligent and he's canny. And then someone asked me yesterday, well, how come it all went south? Well, it went south for the Masons because he endowed everybody he knew as a Mason. So they became the largest lodge in Illinois. And then they got expelled from the Masonic order. I mean, it's the kind of – you know, thing that where Joseph just overplays his hand at this period in his life.
Alex Beam is with us. He is the author of the book American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Tomorrow night at 7, he's going to be reading and signing from his book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. And then on Thursday evening at 6, he's going to speak at Dolly's Bookstore there in Park City. You can get more information on both of those events at our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. You can join us, by the way, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Alex Beam is with us to talk about his new book that tells the story of Joseph Smith's murder. It's called American Crucifixion. He's going to be speaking and reading from the book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake. On Thursday, he'll be in Park City at the Dolly's Bookstore there. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. I want to ask you about, obviously, polygamy is one of those, religious innovations that he comes to. But let me ask you this sort of straightforwardly. Was polygamy – I mean, it's complicated, so this might be too simple-minded. But was, in essence, was polygamy Joseph Smith's undoing?
I happen to think so. It is complicated, but polygamy is the short path to the creation of the small Mormon dissident movement, small but powerful because the leader, William Law, is rich. Yeah. And, you know, it's the path that leads to the publication of the apostate newspaper, and it's Joseph's extremely poor judgment of literally destroying the printing presses of the so-called Nauvoo Expositor that leads directly to his indictment, ultimately his summoning to Carthage, his kind of false imprisonment that is, in fact, just prefatory material to his lynching.
You point out that this wasn't just Joseph Smith's idea. There's a utopian leader of the time, John Humphrey Noyes. There was a man, very strange man named Robert Matthews, who has these ideas about polygamy. So it was sort of in the air. I mean, it was novel. It was people were horrified by the concept, but it wasn't. I suppose it was part of the idea at the time.
Well, it definitely was, and this is an issue of scholarship where I am lacking, and I don't think the scholarship has honestly been done. There's a detail in my book. I believe Orson Pratt visits a polygamist commune in Maine, run by yet another polygamist sect. So it's highly possible that in upstate New York, Joseph is I wouldn't use the metaphor of drinking, but is sort of hearing or via osmosis something is coming forward about polygamy. Also, I mean, anyone, you know, any reasonably well-educated Mormon, which there are about 500,000 listening to this exchange, I mean, Joseph is deeply committed to both the Old and New Testaments, but he's very deeply committed to the Old Testament, and he speaks, of course, of of Abraham and others, men who took multiple wives and various forms of marriages. He's speaking of a restoration of the Old Testament gospel with a lot of New Testament Phillips. So, I mean, he easily could feel he's on somewhat solid ground.
What do you say to the contention that it was just kind of this elaborate excuse to have sex?
I certainly in my book, I think I would shy away from saying that.
You acknowledge there's prurience here, but you say it wasn't just about the sex.
Well, I do feel there's prurience here. There's nothing in the book that says he's a sex maniac. I describe so many incidents, and others have. I'm standing on the shoulders of other writers here, Todd Compton with his amazing book In Sacred Loneliness, George Smith's book, and others. I mean, these encounters are so astonishing, and they're with younger women. They have a religious overlay. I'm now 60. I remember being in my mid-20s and early 30s, and I think the adjective priapic, which is a sort of fancy dictionary adjective, I guess satiriosity would be. I mean, yeah, he seems like a guy who really enjoys the physical company of women.
It's interesting that some of the saints at the time are kind of freaking out. You tell one story from 1835, I think it was 1835, where these rumors are going about the community about plural marriage and misbehavior of Joseph Smith. And so he goes off on a trip. I can't remember where he is. And while he's gone, they adopt this measure that says a man should only have one wife, a wife should only have one husband. So clearly they're worried.
You need to read. I think they also specifically mentioned polygamy. They said, "And we are not a religion that practices polygamy." This is Kirtland. I'm not an expert in Kirtland. This is when the church will actually dissolve in Kirtland and then sort of reform itself in Missouri for various reasons. Yeah, I mean, someone assailed me on this point and saying, just the fact that they issued a statement denying that they practice polygamy doesn't mean they practice polygamy. I don't know. I'm in an Alice in Wonderland situation here. You know, if I issue a statement saying I didn't defraud my wife of $400,000, I think you'd have a legitimate, you know, understanding that maybe I defrauded my wife of $150,000. I mean, so the timeline of polygamy is extremely, again, the subject of super serious academic analysis. And I've been brushing up on it, shall we say, from my visit to the Salt Lake Basin. I mean, I I'll be very brief, but I disassociate myself with the idea that Joseph's first sexual encounter with a woman other than his wife, a Fanny Alger incident, I hope I have that name right, where he's caught having sex with a woman in a barn. I was super surprised to review Richard Bushman's treatment of this. Bushman says, oh, well, it was under the aegis of a polygamous relationship. I and others do not accept that. I feel that this is an incident with a young girl in a barn, and it is what it is. It's been characterized as an ugly – and so I start deviating from the polygamy story, like right there at the beginning. I need to make that clear.
There are a lot of stories about Joseph Smith, obviously, and the women he may have tried to seduce or tried to marry. But I want to talk about one in particular, Mary Rawlins, because she seems like such a remarkable person. I mean, she's a really talented seamstress. She has this kind of gift for languages. Tell us a little bit about Mary Rawlins.
Well, I write about Mary Rawlins for several reasons, but her story is so dramatic because as a young girl in Kirtland, Ohio, she's kind of precocious, and her parents bring her into what kind of feels like a séance. I mean, how can I recreate it mentally? But Joseph Smith has come to her parents' home, obviously, to talk probably in charismatic fashion about the Book of Mormon, and they invite their little daughter in, who's memorized a few lines from one Nephi, and Joseph essentially sort of pats her on the head and he says, what a good little girl you are. You've memorized some lines from the Book of Mormon. That's excellent. Anyway, when she's 23 years old in Nauvoo, married.
To a non-Mormon.
To a non-Mormon, yes.
It's so interesting. Adam Leitner is his name.
Right. I mean, Joseph basically, you know, there's nothing distinctive about the way he approaches Mary Rollins, because he approaches dozens of women this way. He says, you know, there's been a revelation about polygamy.
Well, let's make this clear, because this is important. She has two kids. She's pregnant.
Yeah, she's pregnant. Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, it seems unspeakable.
He's 36.
Right, and she's 23, I believe.
She has two kids and pregnant. He is 36, has four children. And we should also just point out, secretly, he's married to eight women at the time.
Correct.
Okay, just wanted that little context.
Right. I mean, I have since become acquainted with a sort of a radical apologist take on this, which says that this marriage is appropriate because Rollins is married to a non-Mormon, which, again, is just crazy for me. But, I mean, to get into briefly, I mean, the pitch is the same, and it repeats itself. You know, he tells her there's been this new revelation. He himself, of course, is uncomfortable with it, but the angel with the flaming sword has made him accept the doctrine of polygamy, and that she – if she denies him and chooses not to become his wife, you know, she'll be visited. You know, she'll suffer some kind of torment. And she says, well, I don't know. This doesn't sound like it's for me. And he says, well, you're probably going to be visited by an angel yourself. And then she says, well, maybe it'll be an angel of Satan. Because, I mean, what's
fascinating? She really pushes back on him.
Well, as many women do, by the way. Not all women succumb to Joseph's blandishments, to be sure. I mean, I'm not sure that my book has scripture on this. But, I mean, this is a very moral country, America in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. I mean, Brigham Young, utterly fascinating guy. Perhaps I'm not the world's greatest expert on Brigham Young. Brigham loves Joseph. There's no denying it. Brigham will do anything for Joseph. Even Brigham Young says, essentially, are you kidding me? You know, I'm married. I mean, this is a religion. These people are, I mean, I happen to be someone who's been married for a long time. I mean, these people are, you know, are in the embrace of something they believe to be sacred. And here's Joseph saying, essentially, throw away these sacred bonds. And the initial reaction is always horror.
She eventually does marry him while her husband is out of town.
Right. She does marry him. And what the sequelae to that relationship is, you know, I know she goes to Utah, and that's about all I know. To be honest, I can't remember what I wrote. I rather suspect she might have become a wife of Brigham Young's because that was almost a ritual. And I'm not saying in essentially that she – Brigham sealed himself to many of the wives of Joseph after Joseph's death.
There's a kind of a disturbing sort of characteristic to this experience too, when he's rebuffed – or when he is challenged by – because he did this often. I mean, there's this, I have to say, horrifying story from 1841 where he tells his friend and associate Heber Kimball that God had commanded him to marry his wife, Kimball's wife. And then he says it's a test, and, you know, Heber Kimball's all freaked out. And then he says, no, it was just a test, but I do want to marry your 14-year-old daughter.
Right. I mean, now there's a radical apologist line that says that Kimball offered his 14-year-old daughter to Joseph, which is, of course, equally horrifying. I mean, this is detailed in my book. This is Helen Marr Kimball, who later writes about this experience. She's it sounds utterly horrifying. I mean, I need, again, for purposes of fairness, to point out that it was legal to marry a woman at age 12 in Illinois at this time, and she's 14. But, I mean, there's a certain – I would argue almost a modern sounding tone to her account. Like, she is very uncomfortable. She
thinks it's just a ceremony too at first.
Yes.
At least that's what she says.
Yes,
she had no idea that it meant sex.
Right. She later testifies that if I had known what it meant, I'm not sure. I mean, but at 14, who has agency? You know, your parents are deeply committed to the church. That story has a bit of a disturbingly modern feel to me, and not a good feel at all.
The thing I was mentioning, though, was that when he was rebuffed, because this happens to another friend, another associate, LDS Apostle Orson Pratt. He tries to seduce Orson Pratt's wife, so says the story, while Pratt's away
in England. Yeah.
In England, and then. But then he does this thing, and you mentioned in the book that he does this a few times. He tries to then smear her and smear him. This was a tactic.
This happens quite a bit, and it is it is quite disturbing to the modern reader. It's disturbing in itself. Sidney Riggins' daughter Nancy is a very beautiful young girl whom several Mormon leaders are interested in, and she basically leaves town. She flees on the advice of her father, I suspect, and she's sort of branded a whore. This happens again with William Law's beautiful wife, Jane Law, where Joseph is always very eager to sort of, you know, to jump in and confuse the story of what happened. It's like, I didn't make a pass at her. She came on to me. She's a whore. And so you have this, again, you have these repeated stories. The fact is that the fourth time the same story comes, like Brotherton, the very dramatic account of this British girl whom Brigham and Joseph try to seduce, and then she actually goes to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and, like, you know, gives them the most dramatic headline they've ever had. And then Joseph and Brigham say, oh, she's a whore. In fact, her family says she's a whore, you know, because they've remained faithful to the church. I mean, this would be credible if you didn't hear it like four, five, six, seven times. And of course, now I can't speak to 1843 or 1844, but to our ears, this is astonishingly horrible.
The story about William Law that you mentioned, he, of course, is a member, was anyway, of Joseph Smith's inner circle, a member of the First Presidency, wealthy, successful, and he has this beautiful wife, Jane Law, who, as the story goes, Joseph comes on to her. And that's a crucial sort of – this is sort of the tipping point, at least for this story, because, of course, William Law leaves the church and he's the one that creates this dissident newspaper, The Expositor, and that's where the story sort of lights fire.
And he starts a new religion called, you know, the Reformed Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I realized I have to emphasize, I mean, it's a small religion, okay? Apparently he has
300 or something.
Yeah,
like
300
that.
Out of a group of 12,000. I come at this pretty directly. I mean, the problem with making Law an enemy is that Law has tremendous self-confidence, is powerful, and is rich. He has a lot of real estate, as I go into. He's essentially a rival to Joseph Smith for power and influence in Nauvoo. Just the wrong person to make an enemy of. Joseph is supremely confident, again, at this time of his life. He is totally confident that William Law, the Foster brothers, the Higbees, he's going to run them all down.
Alex Beam is with us. His book is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Tomorrow night at 7, he's going to be reading and signing the book at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. Thursday night, he'll be at Dolly's Bookstore in Park City. That's at 6 o'clock. You can get all of that information on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the journalist Alex Beam. We're talking about his new book, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. He's in Utah to read. He'll be reading at two bookstores, one in Salt Lake, one in Park City. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. So let's talk a little bit about this newspaper is essentially trashed and burned. And then things start to really heat up and the momentum really trips along, and this is where the story starts to come to a head. There's this idea – it seems like in some way it's this myth that you hear about Joseph Smith had sort of surrendered to this not only to the authorities, but he's also sort of submitting to the inevitable, that, as he says, he's going as a lamb to the slaughter, that he's giving in. But the perspective you offer, and others have too, is that – it didn't quite work just like that. He was he escaped. He sort of ran, and he's chastised by some within the church, among them his wife, to say, you need to come back. Talk a little bit about that part.
Well, the opening scene of my book, is four men in a boat. I mean, it's a great scene for me because I get to introduce the reader to some great characters, obviously including Joseph and Hiram, his brother, who are destined to die in the Carthage jailhouse. But yeah, his first instinct, generally speaking, is to go the other way, is to flee westwards across the Mississippi from the arm of the law. I mean, the Carthage has sent the constable to Nauvoo twice to bring Joseph in. He slipped the noose, so to speak. He flees across to the Iowa Territory. And indeed, I mean, Emma sends him a message. Emma, it's essentially sort of a collective message saying, you can't do this, you know. What we haven't talked about is that Hancock County is sort of on fire at this time. Yeah. There's a lot of people running around with guns, a lot of people who hate Mormons. Their numbers are in the hundreds. For Joseph to be in some sense be experiencing trepidation is a completely
understandable,
legitimate concern. In any case, Emma sends him a letter. It's delivered to him, and she says – she doesn't say you have to go to Carthage and face justice, but she says you must come back to Nauvoo. This is your flock. There's 12,000 of us here. You are our leader. And, you know, it's interesting and mildly disturbing to note that this is later used by Brigham Young against Emma Smith when the two churches divide into the Utah Church and, the old Josephites who stay in Illinois. Brigham says, look what Emma did. She forced Joseph to come back and die, which is really a total mischaracterization of what happens. Joseph does come back. You know, he quote-unquote does the right thing. There's a genuine, reason. Super well-informed academics disagree about the quote-unquote inevitability of his death.
Yeah.
Joseph is very intelligent. Joseph has been in jail before. Joseph has faced a firing squad before. Joseph has dealt with people who wanted to kill him before. So I think, in all honesty, there's like any human being, he has a sense of dread, which he vocalizes. But of course, as you know, the final act of his life is to write a letter to Orville Browning, sort of the Alan Dershowitz of his time. Orville Browning's a guy who can get him out of this fix. I mean, alas, it's too late. So, I mean, he's experiencing more than one thing when he decides ultimately to take that kind of fateful first step towards Carthage.
There's a question that comes up. Could Joseph Smith have gotten a fair trial in the context of that?
Absolutely not. It's totally out of the question. I mean, again, we haven't discussed – but to be fair, my book does discuss Joseph has real enemies, real powerful enemies, real powerful unscrupulous enemies, armed enemies, motivated by hatred. I mean, one of them, a relatively minor player, is this militia captain named Robert Smith. And I do kind of, you know, take advantage of this fact. I mean, he's dispensing justice in Carthage. What? A man who's the head of a militia unit that's determined to kill Joseph Smith turns out to be the magistrate in Carthage, Illinois. I guess he has some like rudimentary idea about the law or something.
He's a really petty guy.
Yeah, well, he's a horrible person. He's a violent person. And I'm going to use a bad word sort of on the air, but when Joseph and his entourage show up. Okay, I won't use a bad word. But when they show up in Carthage –
is this the N-word that you're
talking about? No, I was going to say they get screwed.
Oh, right.
They just get screwed. I mean, because they show up – and again, I mean, justice, the law, it's kind of – even Abraham Lincoln, you know, it's a kind of seat of the pants in Illinois at this time. But the deck is stacked. The dice are loaded. Joseph's enemies are there whispering in Robert Smith's ear. Not that he needs them to whisper. Joseph does have a lawyer, Esquire Wood. I'm embarrassed. I think it's James Wood. He has a lawyer, but Smith doesn't care about this lawyer. And the lawyer says, you know, there is the doctrine of habeas corpus on which, in fact, the entire English justice system is founded. Robert Smith says, bleep habeas corpus, not for you, pal.
Yeah.
In fact, he says the opposite. He says, not only are we not going to free you after 24 hours, as we know we should, we're going to lock you up for an extra 3 days. So there'll be an even greater chance that you're lynched here in jail.
And the story, of course, that I think people have heard, but it's an extraordinary moment. One thing I hadn't realized, and I think a lot of people do know this part of the story, it's 5 o'clock in the evening. It's June. So about this time of the year, think about what's going on at 5 o'clock in the evening. He's gunned down in broad daylight.
Right. There's 4 people in the jail cell. Joseph, his brother Hiram, Willard Richards, his faithful scribe, and the astonishing John Taylor. Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated story because, of course, the perfidious governor Thomas Ford, the governor of Illinois, who had promised Joseph safety here in Carthage, and that, you know, we're going to sort this all out, and there's going to be some kind of jurisprudence. He lies to Joseph. He chooses not to take Joseph on a visit to Nauvoo, which he had promised. There's a lot of moving pieces here. This allows the Warsaw militia gets word of the fact that Ford is going to Nauvoo, so thus they feel there'll be sort of no order left in Carthage. So they choose to go to Carthage. They and the Carthage Greys, who are already in Carthage, in a sense, come together in this, for them, rather blissful encounter where there's these hundreds of men who are going to shoot Joseph in cold blood.
So interesting, because you hear about the story as it's just, as you said, the sort of story in school that you read is mob. It's a mob. But I mentioned this in the introduction. There's a prominent newspaper editor in this so-called mob. There's a state senator. There's a justice of the peace. You've got two regimental military commanders in this mob. And you've got men who were not – it wasn't so long ago that they were faithful members of the Mormon Church.
Right. It's called – what's it called? He's put to death by a group of honorable men. And it is
– respectable set of men.
Excuse me. Yeah. Respectable set of men. Yeah, they were definitely respectable. Some of them were past war heroes in the Black Hawk War, and they were destined to become Civil War heroes. I mean, they were all animated. I mean, Joseph had just made people so angry. You know, there's a chapter in my book called Everybody Hates the Mormons. I mean, I go through – it's not one thing. It's four or five things. But for a combination of religious hatred, economic envy, the Mormons are successful – political anger, the Mormons are controlling politics. I mean, all these, all these respectable people, they are moved to rage, and they cross the line. You asked the question before, but it's still bare. You know, there was going to be no fair trial for Joseph Smith, and indeed, interestingly enough, Brigham always knew this. Brigham said, you know, that he'll never get a fair trial, and Brigham spoke to the next trial, the trial of the men who supposedly, you know, were responsible for Smith's death. Brigham told the saints, forget about it, don't go to testify, it's not worth it. Gentile justice, it's loaded. Well, he was right.
It was a show trial.
It was a show trial. It was a fake trial. I mean, there were great lawyers. I mean, I have a patina of modesty, but I think this is a fantastic chapter in my book because it's such a kangaroo farce. The best book actually is co-authored by, I believe it, a current apostle, the LDS Church. Dallin Oaks is the co-author of a book called Carthage Conspiracy about the trial. Superb book. But it's a monkey trial. It's a sham. There's loaded guns in the courtroom. Brigham's very wise to advise the Mormons not to show up. I mean, the judge isn't particularly corrupt, but I mean, there's no Mormons on the jury, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the greatest irony, and I certainly don't hide this at all, is that the men who shot Joseph Smith aren't actually the men who are on trial. Those guys have split. So, I mean, it's an outrage, and Mormons should be outraged. They should be outraged at this incident in American history.
You point out in the book that Mormons have this fervent, bloody-minded faith in retribution, in justice. And you point out Heber Kimball said that he and others would never rest until those men who killed Joseph Smith had been wiped out from the earth. Talk about this part of the book, because I was interested in this idea of retribution, because there was some sense, even one idea, that the Civil War had been God's act of revenge on the country for killing their prophet.
Yeah. I mean, I found this quite fascinating. I mean, completely new to me. I would say pretty widely unknown in America. I mean, what's interesting, the Mormons had this kind of army. I think it had the elements of fakery, but it was called the Nauvoo Legion. And so hypothetically, they could have struck back after Joseph's death and attacked Carthage. They could have massacred everybody. There's so many more Mormons than there were non-Mormons. But they didn't. And instead, they took this attitude that God will sort this out, that Joseph's enemies will be at the bar before God. First, one thing you're referring to is this the oath of vengeance. I mean, it became a part of the endowment ceremony.
Yeah, the temple ceremony.
Temple ceremony for every male Mormon. I mean, I make much of this. I even wrote a newspaper column about this saying, hello, Mitt Romney's grandfather, thus the father of George Romney, took an oath to destroy the United States of America. And I think people need to be reasonable, maybe more reasonable than me. I mean, we are an interesting country because things change. And God bless the fact. Believe me, Mitt Romney did not take the oath of vengeance. It was eliminated in 1923, and I don't want to even imply that. But Reed Smoot did take the oath of vengeance. I'm convinced of that, and he lied about it before the Senate during his confirmation hearings. But having said that, there was a parallel belief an excellent Mormon historian told me to read this book called The Fate of the Persecutors of Joseph Smith, the most stolen book from the Salt Lake City library system, where they explain the Mormon curse, which is actually entirely fictional but still irresistible for a writer, where there's this kind of Mormon mythology. It takes place sort of out there in the West, that the mobbers who killed Joseph Smith developed cancer of the eye, or they started separating from every gland in their body. And I mean, I would be just as happy if that had in fact happened to the men who killed Joseph Smith. But I mean, everybody knows that these were myths, because the people who were deemed to have taken part, you know, what happened is, this gets super complicated, is that in the West, people started bragging. People wanted it in their obituary that they fired a shot at Joseph Smith. Anyway, this whole meta world of fantasy starts taking place, and it's a fascinating part of my book.
I wanted to ask you this finally, and it's one of those sort of questions you can't really answer. It's one of those what if questions, because you point out Brigham Young brought the Saints West. He was a better organizer. He better at a lot of things from Joseph Smith. What would have happened if Joseph Smith had survived? Do you have any sense of that now, after having spent all this time with this book?
It's funny. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about that question, to be honest. I mean, in the fact, in a sense, this was the fate of the Mormon Church, because it brought us here, and Brigham brought us here in the Astonishing Trek. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. Joseph had his eyes on the West. There's no doubt about that. It wasn't Brigham's idea. It was Joseph's idea, okay? Joseph had his eyes on the West. I don't know. The problem is that the killing is so brutal and unmotivated that, of course, it's the final straw. I mean, finally the Mormons get the idea they're not welcome in the United States, and they leave the United States. Joseph has a very complicated history with American power. I don't know. I mean, in a sense, it took his killing for the collective unconscious of the Mormons to finally say, they hate us, we must leave.
Alex Beam is the author of the book American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. He's in Utah to give readings tomorrow night at the King's English Bookshop at 7 o'clock, Thursday night at Dolly's Bookstore in Park City. That's at 6 o'clock. For details, just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Alex Beam, thanks very much for the time.
Doug, thank you for your attention. It was great.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.